And what happens while we're jaunting around the world? Do I get bitten by a cobra at the Taj Mahal, or do I have a skiing accident on the Southern Alps? Lucido burst into tears. I swear, Dan, you are wrong. Nothing. No, of course not. I'm imagining the whole thing. You just suddenly decided that you're madly in love with me, and if I'll just stop fighting against the Russians and run away with you, you'll be mine forever and ever. Bullshit. She got up from the sofa like a prize fighter lifting himself from the canvas after being knocked down. Sobbing, she ran across the dimly lit living room toward the front door. The robot butler, sensing a human body in motion, rolled after her. May I show you to the door? It asked. But Lucita was already there and through before the robot could open the door for her. Good evening, it said politely. As the robot gently shut the door, Dan stood silent and immobile. And alone. Chapter 30. The first snowfall of the year. Vasily Malik looked past the stern-faced men sitting across the table from him, and out to the long windows and the pewter gray clouds that pressed down against the spires and domes of the Kremlin. His soul felt just as dreary as the wintry scene outside. It was barely October. The parade celebrating the beginning of the revolution and the anniversary of the first Sputnik had hardly cleared Red Square, and it was already snowing. Thick, wet flakes drifted down, as inexorable as the rotation of the world on its axis, as remorseless as the comrades who sat arrayed around this heavy, dark conference table, their displeasure focused entirely upon him. He thought of Caracas, how sunny and warm it would be, even in October, even in December. But that was merely geography, climate. There was no human warmth in Caracas, not for him. He and Lucita were to be married in little more than 2 months, yet she was as cold and distant as the farthest planet. As far as she was concerned, Malik knew it would be a political marriage, nothing more. But I will make it more than that, he thought. She won't be frigid with me. I'll thaw her, even if it takes force. The ornately carved door at the far end of the conference room swung open, and the premier shuffled in. How ironic, Malik thought, that the youngest man in 3 decades to lead the government and the party should suffer a stroke. It almost makes one believe in God, or at least in fate. But the premier clung to his power like a shipwrecked sailor clutching a scrap of flotsam. All the ministers got to their feet as the premier entered, dragging his left foot slightly as he came to his chair at the head of the table. A uniformed guard held the chair for him. He sat and placed his paralyzed left hand in his lap. Once seated and comfortably arranged, he looked almost normal. The stroke had left scant traces on his face, and his speech had not been impaired. The outside world saw him only thus, either already seated or atop the reviewing stand at Red Square, so far distant from the crowds and photographers that not even his limp could be noticed. "This emergency meeting of the Council of Ministers will come to order," said the Premier. His voice had always been soft, almost dulcet. His face, gaunt and lined just after the stroke, had filled out almost to its former healthy condition. The pallor on his cheeks was hidden by makeup when necessary. The ministers sat. Malik was easily the youngest among them, flanked on either side by men of his father's generation. And the ministers across the table from him were even older, especially Marshal Titov, who looked already embalmed, like an Egyptian mummy in a soldier's uniform. Malik wondered how the old warrior found the strength to stand up, especially under the load of medals he always wore. Even among the aides sitting behind the various ministers and secretaries, hardly any were younger than Malik. The premier nodded to the council secretary sitting at his right. "There is only one subject on the agenda," said the secretary. He was a chubby, balding, pink-faced pig of a man, Malik thought, with tiny, beady eyes almost hidden in his bloated face. When Malik had been on the rise, the secretary had been his friend and ally. But the past few weeks he had shown his true colors. "The depredations caused by these so-called pirates," said the premier. Every eye around the table turned to focus on Malik. He smiled sardonically. "With all respect, Comrade Chairman, they are not merely so-called pirates. What is happening is piracy, pure and simple." "And it must be stopped," growled old Marshal Titov. The foreign minister, who sat at the premier's left hand and fancied himself next in line for the top position, held up his hands placatingly. "The position we find ourselves in is neither pure nor simple," he said to the Premier, speaking so low that the others had to strain to hear him. "Officially, the Organization of Latin American States, led by the government of Venezuela, has taken the position in the World Court that the Soviet Union has illegally seized the cargo of one of their spacecraft, the one that was carrying samples of rock from an asteroid." "Where is that asteroid now?" the Premier asked, proving that his mind was still quick. "Has it entered a fixed orbit around the Earth?" "Not yet, Comrade Chairman, but it will," Malik replied. "Our astronomers have confirmed that it will orbit at the same distance as the Moon itself, nearly 400,000 kilometers away." "Then there is no danger of it falling on Earth?" "Not unless someone pushes it out of orbit." The Premier nodded somewhat stiffly and turned back to the Foreign Minister. He cleared his throat and resumed. "Our legal position is somewhat," he groped for a word, "somewhat contradictory. On the one hand, we maintain that we have the right to seize the cargo of the Venezuelan spacecraft and even to detain its crew. On the other, we maintain that no one has the right to seize the cargoes of our spacecraft carrying ores between the Moon and the space stations in orbit around the Earth." "Excuse me, Comrade Minister," said Malik, "but there is no contradiction at all. The Soviet Union has the approval of the International Astronautical Council to carry all ore shipments between the Moon and the space stations. The capitalist asteroid mission was not approved by the IAC, and certainly no one in the IAC or the United Nations gave permission for the capitalists to move that body of rock out of its natural orbit." "It can't fall on the Earth, can it?" the Premier asked again. "No, sir," Malik repeated. "Not unless the capitalists deliberately alter its orbit once again." The Premier's waxen complexion paled even further. "Would they do that?" Malik spread his hands, the equivalent of a shrug. "My information is that the capitalists brought the asteroid into orbit around the Earth so that they can use it more conveniently as a mining base, a source of metals and minerals." The Minister of Industry stirred. "That would compete with our lunar ores," he rasped in his dry, aged voice. "To some degree," Malik conceded. "But they're not allowed to do that. Only the Soviet Union has the right to mine ores in space." Malik fought down the urge to remind the Minister of Industry that he had explained the situation at the last two council meetings. Instead, he patiently explained again, "We have the exclusive right to mine ores from the Moon, Comrade Minister, and transport them to the space stations. There has been no ruling by the IAC on mining asteroids." The withered little man looked puzzled. He turned to the aide sitting behind him and exchanged a few hurriedly whispered words with him. Malik guessed that he was asking what an asteroid was. "We are drifting off the subject," said the Premier. "What are we going to do about these acts of piracy?" "Pirates should be hanged," snapped the Minister of Transportation sitting on Malik's left. He was the next youngest man at the table and had long been Malik's rival. "Find them and hang them, every last one." "It's not that easy," Malik said. "They don't fly the skull and crossbones, you know. They don't show themselves publicly." "You know who they are," the transportation minister insisted. "We all know who their ringleader is. The American, Randolph." Malik nodded. "He started it, of that I am certain. But over the past 6 weeks, acts of piracy have grown far beyond what Randolph alone is capable of doing." Focusing directly upon the Premier, Malik went on. 6 weeks ago, the pirates made their first raid and stole one of our ore freighters. Within a week, two more freighters were looted of their cargoes. On the same day, the following week, it was three freighters. On the same day, two on one day, the third 2 days later. The Premier absently rubbed his paralyzed arm as Malik continued. "Since then, not a week has gone past without at least one ore freighter being emptied of its cargo or stolen altogether." "Outrageous!" snapped the transportation minister. "Yes, it is. And it is the work of more than one organization. Randolph and his group working from the Venezuelan space station could not possibly be doing all this by themselves. The space organizations of the other third world nations are also helping themselves to our ore shipments. Apparently, they send the ores to the Chinese space complex, which then exports them to the various third world factories as excess Chinese material." Marshal Titoff's shaggy white brows knitted together in a frown that would have been ferocious in a younger man. "Then round them all up, Seize all these space stations and send their crews to the lunar mines. That will stop the pirates.